In this week's programme, a book about scientific curiosity by Philip Ball. The author is a science writer and consultant editor with the journal Nature. He has a PhD in physics from Bristol University. Until the 17th century, he tells us, curiosity was reviled. It was associated with prying into things that didn't concern us. When curiosity was sanctioned, it didn't automatically ensure the emergence of experimental science, which is the central focus of this writer's interest. Surprisingly, in the mid-16th century, the closest thing to experimental science was magic. The author of this book takes the view that magic has had a bad press. He does his best to show that magic has a more respectable intellectual ancestry than is commonly assumed. Furthermore, he does not accept the widely held view that in the 17th century there was a sharp discontinuity between magic and experimental science. He sees them as more of a piece. With me, David McConnell, who's a geneticist, Ruth Byrne, who's a cognitive scientist, Paul O'Grady, a philosopher. All three teach at Trinity College Dublin. David McConnell, what did you make of this?
Well, it's a rattling good read, fundamentally, full of interesting information, an awful lot of which I knew nothing about. Lovely little side pictures of the way in which science supposedly emerged from the 1500s onwards. I thought it was really charming. And I mean, I think anybody with an interest in science, the history of science, or indeed the history of the Renaissance, the Enlightenment, they would all, of course, enjoy it. But I would have thought it's highly accessible to a very wide readership.
Didn't raise any hackles in you when you
were in the book? Well, it did raise some hackles, I must say. But they were more than counterbalanced by some beautiful comments. One, for example, about people collecting information for no apparent purpose, which is an affliction of my own field at the moment. There's a field called systems biology, and you have people collecting enormous amounts of data and filling up computers all over the world with it. And I asked myself, why? What are they doing? And he holds the same view as I do. And he goes with Weinberg. He has a lovely quotation from Weinberg, the American physicist, about the importance of hypothesis-driven science carried out by small numbers of people.
You know what the physicists know what they're looking for. It's really the
Well, sometimes they do and sometimes they don't, I suspect. But
They're not mere data gatherers, is his point, isn't that right?
Well, of course, some people who collect vast amounts of data are collecting it for a very particular reason. And he gives the Large Hadron Collider as an example, yes, and the search for the Higgs boson, which we may or may not have found. I mean, he rather dumps on those journeymen of science.
But, I mean, forgive me, he dumps on your own field, and you're in agreement with him on that.
Oh, but those are not the journeymen of science. These are the people who are apparently leading the field at the moment, which I do not like very much, because I think they're using a vast amount of resources and consuming a vast amount of young students who get embroiled in these vast projects without, I think, any real understanding of what the papers which are published by these teams may have 40 or 50 authors. I'm quite confident that only about two or three of the authors know what the paper's about. The others are just but they're very, very intelligent people, and they've been pulled into this gathering of data. So
Does that inflict all of the sciences? I mean, he's exempting, by and large, physics from it. Does it, Ruth, is it your impression that infects all of the sciences, that emphasis on data gathering?
I think what's fascinating about this book is how he really tracks the development of scientific thinking. And really what we do now is very different from what was done during the 1600s. His primary interest, I think, is in trying to provide us with some clues about how that profound change occurred. That up until the late 1500s, early 1600s, people were really thinking in a medieval way, engaged with magic and alchemy and the occult. And there was this profound change occurred where people began to think, at least pre-scientifically, where they began to think about the world in a very different way. And I think he's quite persuasive in identifying some of the factors that may have led to that. So he wants us to move away, as many historians do, I think, from this cosy view of a scientific revolution where it was just black and white.
Yeah.
One day everybody was thinking one way, and then...
So you agree with him that there wasn't a sharp discontinuity between a world of magic and mysticism, if you like, on the one hand, a world of experimental science on the other. You agree with
him? I was persuaded by him because he gives fascinating examples. He gives examples even of, for example, Boyle or Newton, who are viewed as very respectable scientists, and yet from across the centuries, they appear to us to have held wildly contradictory views. They were engaged equally passionately in studying their topics of gravity or creating vacuums or whatever, but they were also engaged with magic, with the occult.
Yes.
And so one of the points that he makes very convincingly, I think, is that this transition in the way that people thought was a transition that occurred in individual minds, and people were holding inconsistent beliefs and struggling with those inconsistent beliefs.
And gradually out of that emerged that which we call and identify as experimental science today.
Yes, but certainly not by the end of the 1600s. I think it's quite clear from what he describes that the kind of science people were doing was pre-hypothesis driven. It was largely observational. And he's very amusing at certain points about the basic gold standard aspects of current modern science, that you can replicate someone else's experiment, just didn't hold. Because for a start, there was no convention of reporting information in a way that someone else could repeat the experiment. But secondly, they were relying on very new instruments like the telescope or the microscope. Yeah. And those instruments were really hard to manage, and people were afraid to admit that they couldn't see what someone else saw in case it turned out that their microscope or their telescope was inferior.
Right.
So there wasn't the kind of emphasis on replication.
Right. Paul O'Grady, were you persuaded by his emphasis on the lack of discontinuity between a world of magic and science on the other?
Well, there's a sense in which he's trying to rewrite the standard narrative, the standard story of the scientific revolution. And there are ways in which I agree with him and there are ways in which I disagree with him. Just initially, I think I want to agree with David that it's a beautifully written book. It's really, really good popular science, and it really conveys a lot of quite detailed information very lightly. And in that respect, it's really good. The other thing I think is extremely good about the book is the way in which it embeds the scientific narrative in a broader cultural context. So his range of reference is enormous. So he's talking about writers, he's talking about scientists, he's talking about philosophers, and he's talking about the interaction between them. Particularly interesting, say, the interaction between literary figures. Mm. So the impact that this has on Butler, on Swift, on Dryden, on Shadwell, and how they react to the scientific material. So I think all of that is interesting and is really good.
But where do you find yourself at odds with him, if you like?
Well, the standard narrative is that you have this medieval way of looking at the world, and then you have this revolution which breaks with that older way of looking at the world. His focus is on the second part of this, he said there isn't a sharp break, there's a kind of continuation of some of the older ideas. My worry is that in some ways it sets up the medieval view in a way to knock it down. So
in fairness to him, he's not given to kind of stereotyping.
No, and early on in the book he mentions some of the major figures of the medieval time. So page 31, he talks about Albertus Magnus and Aquinas, etc. But the thing that worries me, I think, a little bit is that despite the fact that the word philosophy occurs on almost every page of this book, the meaning of the term is curiously unclear. Now, partly the deal is that the meaning of the term in the 17th century was curiously unclear as to what actually constitutes being a philosopher versus what constitutes being a modern scientist. And there's a mix of views. Yet, nevertheless, I did feel that there was a certain lack of engagement or sympathy in him in terms of thinking about the way that philosophers would think about this. And the particular issue, I guess, I would have with him in terms of the model or the paradigm for doing this kind of narrative is Kuhn. So Kuhn in The Structure of Scientific Revolution has the classic book of the 20th century in introducing the historical method into scientific investigation, and there's absolutely no engagement with that here.
What did you make of... I felt when he started to talk about curiosity and wonder, David, he got into very messy and tricky terrain.
Well, I liked that.
Did you?
Yes, I did. I mean, I could never have imagined myself writing a book entitled Curiosity, although I think curiosity is incredibly important. And he elevates this notion of curiosity to something tremendously important, and also, which I love, something which is incredibly subversive. And he quotes St. Augustine, I think, to the effect that, you really shouldn't try to find out things. That's not a good idea. You won't be able to handle them. I mean, and the whole that I think early view that it's really not a good idea. I mean, even Aristotle, I think, who was more a chronicler, according to him anyway, collected vast amounts of information, including a lot of biology, but really was affected more by wonder than by curiosity.
I wonder, Ruth, does he make clear the distinction?
Well, I think that he one of his key points is that people began to develop a different notion of what new knowledge would actually be. And so they moved away from thinking that everything had been discovered either in the church writings or in Aristotle's writings, and that really the way to pursue new knowledge was to tease out what was already there through your reasoning, through making inferences from it. They moved away from that to instead thinking that perhaps the way to find new knowledge, to make discoveries, is to look around us in the world. And that shift of thinking that everything hasn't already been discovered made them begin to need to have a way to look at things around them in the world. So this shift in what's proper to study led to a shift in how can we study it properly then. And his emphasis on curiosity, I think, is sadly, it doesn't make any systematic contact with the psychological literature on curiosity or with any of the cognitive science.
In terms of the sort of broad psychological matrix, Paul, the idea, for example, he says that wonder has been readmitted because it's useful. As PR people can today say, talking about astronomy, saying, the wonder of the stars and so on. And that in a sense, it's he's really saying wonder was written out of the picture. I'm wondering, I just found that quite unclear.
I worried about the distinction between wonder and curiosity, and I would have liked a more systematic discussion of what this is. It's kind of clear that he thinks that curiosity is in some sense good and that wonder is less good than curiosity. And the reason for that, as he seems to articulate it, is that wonder doesn't seem to produce results or produce some kind of inquiry into the world, where curiosity does seem to do that. Now, I think that's certainly a controversial point, or it's something that people might worry about. Later on in the book, he makes a distinction between good wonder and bad wonder. Good wonder is sort of the stuff that will lead you to further inquiry. Bad wonder is astonishment, which he parses as turning into stone. You're stupefied before something. And in some ways, just this distinction is I'm not exactly convinced of the distinction that's there. And even though he cites Aristotle, so Aristotle at the very beginning of Western philosophy says philosophy begins in wonder. But that then spurs a lot of people to reflect in certain kind of ways. My worry, or one of my worries qua philosopher of a certain kind, is that he has an underlying assumption that the way that you really acquire knowledge about the world is through empirical methods.
Yeah.
And there really isn't any space left for the rational reflective method. I certainly think that's controversial.
Also, from a marketing point of view, which would you do better with, you said, David, today? A book about wonder or a book about curiosity? Which would appeal more?
Well, I must say, I agree with you, of course, Paul and Ruth, that it's a kind of artificial distinction between what's curiosity and what is wonder. But he's defining it. He's saying curiosity is a desire. It amounts to a desire to find out and to explain. Yeah. And he really does say this is...
But I'm just thinking in terms of the popular appeal of the two terms.
Well, you see, wonder is all the ooh-ah stuff. It's sort of Darrow O'Brien and this sort of stuff, and which is great. And Philip Ball, wants to bring wonder back because he thinks it will help science. This is a key idea.
Yes, but would you go along with that notion?
Yes, I do. I do. I mean, I think... When you reflect on even if you go out on a beautiful night and you look at the stars, if you do not have a sense of wonder, well, I don't think there's too much between your ears. I mean, you really, really have to wonder about this thing. I happened to get up in the middle of the night recently down in Kerry, and my wife woke me up and said, "Come and look at this." Looked out the window, and there was a rainbow in the middle of the night. It's called a moonbow. I was absolutely awestruck.
But the whole idea here.
And then I went and read about it, Andy. Sure. And it's incredible.
The idea here, Ruth, is that he's really saying in a way that wonder is only admissible as a kind of PR device when you're talking about the stars and so on.
I don't think that his distinction between curiosity and wonder is one that would have much currency or persuasion within the cognitive science of studying how people become interested in something or how they explore that interest. But I think perhaps what he was trying to distinguish, at least what I got from it, was that there's an emotional component and there's an intellectual component to whatever you call it, curiosity or wonder, and that really it's the intellectual component that he's interested in, because that will actually make you do something about it. It will make you try to find out more about it.
Yeah.
But he doesn't go into, for example, there's an awful lot of research on insight, how people restructure their understanding of something, or on scientific discovery directly, how people manage to actually go about systematically trying to find out something new.
There's an interesting quote from Carlo Ginzburg, the sort of historian of ideas. The evidence-based reasoning that distinguishes science from other modes of thought has its roots not in mathematics deployed by Copernicus and Galileo, but by the imagery of the hunt.
Yeah.
It makes a lot of sense, doesn't it?
He's very good on imagery and actually literary dimensions of things. So early on, when he's discussing Bacon, for example, he talks about how Bacon's discourse is shot through with sexist imagery, in fact, in this early modern period, and what kind of ideology lies behind that. But later on, he has... given it's a very moderate book, a somewhat impassioned phase where he's talking about contemporary scientific writing and he refers to the bloodlessness of much contemporary scientific writing. Given that his own book is actually, I think, quite beautifully written and well written, what he's saying, and I think this is where he tries to rehabilitate wonder in a certain way on his understanding of wonder, is that he says that actually in some way relevant to the scientific project are all these external allegedly idiosyncratic things, like, for example, that the DNA molecule is beautiful, that it was left out of the actual inquiry because we thought this wasn't the kind of thing that you put in, but he thought it was actually relevant, and the scientist's own response to the stuff is part of the data that you need not to write out of the situation.
I just happened to have read the a new edition of The Double Helix, which is Watson's extraordinary book, which was 16 weeks in the New York Times bestseller list. I don't think any scientific book had ever been like that. It was published whenever it was in the early
53, 70s. I think, was it?
No, Discovery was
Discovery 15. 53. When was the book?
The book was sometime in the 60s, or maybe even a bit later. But in any case, there is a new annotated edition of it. And this idea of the hunt, this comes through. This book was two people. It was about two people. Watson and Crick, who were just imbued with the idea that there was something to be found. They were going to get it. It was a hunt. And they were quite relentless, of course, and some people would say even a bit ruthless about it.
Now, Ball makes the point that Bacon got that imagery of the hunt from De La Porta's Natural Magic. In other words, that's where the thing came from. But it is a persuasive notion. The question of the Royal Society gets a rough time here and their lack of interest in theory, does that surprise you or not?
Well, I didn't know an awful lot about the the middle period of the Royal Society, as it were. In the early period, people do know a little bit about. It was hesitant. It did bring together an extraordinary group of people. I mean, just imagine those people coming together anywhere in the world today. De novo, astonishing.
But there's an interesting historical point here where he says the damage done by satirists to the Royal Society and to experimental science, that it led to people afraid of being exposed to ridicule. And then many members, he said, feigned ignorance. They took up trade and business. That's an interesting possible roots of the kind of anti-intellectualism you get.
And swift, responsible.
Go ahead, yes.
Yes, I think so. It very much is a history of the Royal Society to some extent, isn't it? It concentrates an awful lot on the contribution of English scientists to this development during the 1600s. But what's fascinating about it is some of the points it picks out about how people went about satisfying their curiosity. And in particular, I thought it was marvellous, his chapter about cabinets of curiosity.
What? Yes,
cabinets of curiosity, which aren't furniture cabinets. They were entire rooms
The late 16th and early 17th centuries, yes.
Yes, and for example, the Emperor Rudolf II had whole stables and aviaries and menageries, as well as entire rooms of his palace dedicated to his cabinet of curiosities. And there were rules governing how you would, first of all, that you would collect natural objects, that they would be rare, exceptional items. And secondly, there were rules about how you'd organise them, because these weren't... So for some people, their function was just to show off. They were boasting about their exotic possessions.
But you can see that as a pre-scientific stage.
Exactly, because the point that he makes about it is that the rules for how you would place these objects in relation to each other were actually possibly, he doesn't insist on this point, but it's intriguing. He says that possibly this was the first time that people began to attempt to construct a small-scale model of the world, that they were attempting to have a microcosm of the world that they could impose some kind of order on, that they could extract an explanatory framework from. So they were moving beyond a taxonomy to some kind of explanation. And then, of course, sadly, towards the end of the 1600s, they broke down, because with all the development of the exploration of the new worlds, there was just too many exotic creatures and plants and unusual items. So there was. They realised that they couldn't have a microcosm of the world, and they became instead then the best of them, because these were wealthy gentlemen scholars, so some of them collected very impressive cabinets of curiosities, and they became museums. They became the British Museum was the result of several individuals' cabinets of curiosities, and they became publicly accessible. Before that, they were really the purview just of the elite.
That's right, and there was the Ashmolean in Oxford and the origin with Ashmole. But I particularly liked the story of the relation between Boyle and Hooke. So Boyle regarded as the upper-class theorist and Hooke as the lower-class experimentalist. And in some ways, this tension between experiment and theory is part of the leitmotifs of the whole book. That is, are you doing blue skies research such you're just looking out there and trying to find out what happens?
Yes.
Or are you theory-driven in terms of the way that you go?
Yeah.
And he very nicely looks at the difficulties on both sides, so that if you're completely blue skies in that sense, you're just going to get all this data that adds up to nothing. And then the worry is that you're going to be too programmatic if you're completely theory-driven and you're just going to find stuff that's going to confirm your
what you were looking for. Yes.
But again, and coming back to the thing I was saying earlier about there's just this very, very interesting debate in 20th century philosophy of science about, say, between Carnap on one side, who's inductive-driven. So the thing is you check, you use experiment, you observe, and your starting place is experiment. And someone like Popper, who says, well, no, you're going to start with a conjecture and then you're going to test it. So you've got this tension between, do you start primarily with observation, do you start primarily with theory? And then coming after that, you have Kuhn, who disagrees with many of the assumptions that Carnap and Popper have together. Kuhn saying, look, all this sort of social stuff, all this idiosyncratic stuff, all this environmental stuff is actually relevant. You can't write it out and you can't show that it's not relevant.
I'm thinking that the Popper view is a more gradualist one, that Kuhn, again, is more a man of discontinuity, isn't he, of sudden disruption.
Well, the interpretation of Kuhn is really difficult, and Kuhn himself, I think, wrote back on a lot of the interpretations that were made of his work, and the writer Ball adverts to the fact that there's the danger between, on the one hand, having a completely a view of the manner of science that's completely unreal to the way that science goes, that are just
To you, David, is real in terms of the way it's theorised about? Who has got it right, roughly, in the way that science is conducted?
Well, I mean, there's an old saying, you know, that philosophers of science are to scientists like ornithologists are to birds. You know, what do we do? How do we behave in the lab? We're social animals. We exist in a particular time and milieu. Do we behave according to the philosophy of science as written by any of these people?
Yeah.
And the crucial thing, and this is driven into every scientist, of course, is that if the evidence doesn't agree with what you're talking about, or what anybody else has approved, then you've got to be extremely careful. It's evidence-based. And this comes out from Bacon. And by the way, we should perhaps touch on Bacon a bit more, because he occupies a large part of the book. But how do we do science? Well, we have ideas. I think people like Popper and others, I mean, they seem to think that science suddenly starts somewhere, but it never starts somewhere, because there's always something behind.
Ruth?
The cognitive science of it is interesting, because experiments have shown that if you look at what scientists actually do, they do very much what everybody does. We have enormous difficulty, humans do, in testing hypotheses. In particular, we have difficulty in falsifying hypotheses. So we're all, unfortunately, gripped by a confirmation bias or tendency to try to find evidence that fits in with our theories, our explanations.
To
go along
with George Kelly, wasn't it George Kelly who said that we're all, in a sense, scientists manqués. We all approach the world in that way of kind of constructing hypotheses, theories to get along. So
and interestingly, field studies of scientists in biology labs or other kinds of labs that have examined what is it that people spend their time trying to explain, it's the unexpected results, and it is a gradual process where people don't abandon theories overnight. They add different tenets to them to try to shore up gaps in a theory, and it takes a very long time for a paradigm shift to occur. But partly there's checks and balances in science because we are collaborative, but we're also competitive. And so one scientist will be trying to falsify another scientist's hypotheses or explanations. And so perhaps in the social nature of science, it works.
Maybe quicker to do that than trying to falsify one of their own.
Exactly.
But we do. Yeah. We do, nevertheless. I mean, it's certainly in my own field, I mean, there's just extraordinary examples which almost give you an ideal picture of science. And if you take great experiment by Meselson and Stahl, which I was lecturing on to my students yesterday and the day before. Fantastic experiment concerning the replication of DNA. There were three hypotheses. Meselson and Stahl designed an entirely new way of testing these hypotheses. Nobody else had even thought about testing them, actually, although it was a crucial series of tests. Absolutely brilliant science in action. Trouble with people like Kuhn, I would say, is that I think what Ruth is talking about is closer to the point. Kuhn and many other great contributors have focused on very big science, very big moments in science, whereas most science is down in an engine room where very well-meaning, hard-working, ordinary people imbued with science are actually tinkering away with this, that and the other. It's not like what Kuhn
Meaning that the big shifts are rare in terms... I mean, you don't get many in a century, even, yes.
Yeah. And I think one of the advantages of Philip Ball's own experiences in science is that he doesn't idealise science in this book. He's quite clear
that
modern science has all its flaws
and messiness, but he
contrasts it with what was going on during the scientific revolution was very much pre-science. It wasn't anything like what occurs during modern science. And the differences there in the way that people were thinking about how to test hypotheses was really that they were describing the world. They weren't very much explaining it. And there are exceptions, of course. He talks about Galileo, for example, or others as really being individuals that were quite different from everybody else.
We've been discussing Curiosity, How Science Became Interested in Everything by Philip Ball, published by Bodley Ahead. My thanks to Ruth Byrne, Paul O'Grady and David McConnell. You can listen to the programme again on our off-the-shelf website at rte.ie and on the RTE player. Till next week, bye-bye.